I'm Vermont Edition co-host Bob Kinzel. Just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The president delivered his first State of the Union address last night, and the response from the Vermont delegation was swift and harsh. Quote, he is alienating our international friends and allies, weakening our global leadership, ceding power to other nations that do not share our values, and threatening our long-term security, said Senator Patrick Leahy in a statement emailed out after the speech. Bernie Sanders delivered his own retort in a video on Facebook Live. In his prepared statement, he said, quote, what is also important to note is not just Trump's dishonesty. It is that tonight he avoided some of the most important issues facing our country and the world. And Vermont's lone congressman in the House of Representatives, Peter Welch, also had some sharp words, but I'll let him deliver them in person. Today on the show, Congressman Welch joins us to talk about what he heard in the speech last night and then to move on to other issues that he's working on in Washington, many of which, of course, dovetail with the president's remarks. Peter Welch, it's nice to talk with you again.
Thank you.
All right. So your takeaway from last night's speech?
Well, there's two things. In the very short term, any president delivering a State of the Union address is going to get a bit of a bump. He has the microphone. He has America watching, and it's provided in the House of Representatives with the full House, Senate, Cabinet, and Supreme Court there. It's an august ceremony. And the president spoke calmly. And he also deployed the opportunity to give examples of people who have done heroic things. And regardless of your party, regardless of what you think about the president, I think a lot of us want to celebrate brave actions by American citizens in times of peril. So that is going to help him in the short term. But the substance of it, when you really analyze it, doesn't show that there's any change in the approach Donald Trump is taking. He's celebrating his tax cut. Pardon me?
Did you expect any change?
I didn't really, but hope springs eternal. But we've got a year of this presidency, so actions actually now are much more important than what the words are. But there was an absence of words in that speech, as well as some of the things he said that I found very disturbing. First of all, he's trumpeting the tax cut. And that has been very beneficial to our largest corporations. If you are one of the 400 wealthiest families, you won't be paying an estate tax soon or very little. And there were some temporary and quite small tax benefits that went to the middle class. No, they're going to expire. But the real challenge in our economy continues to be that the purchasing power for everyday people in Vermont and around the country, especially rural America, is about the same level as it was in 1979. How do we get wages up? It's something that even Governor Scott talks about in Vermont. The president didn't address that. So you've got this tale of two Americas where is he going to face the challenges that are really stubbornly persistent for folks in Vermont, especially rural Vermont and in rural America? And ironically, those are the people that elected him, but he really is not addressing that need. Secondly, he talked about infrastructure, but there were no details on how you're going to pay for it. And in fact, in that infrastructure address, he didn't utter a single word about broadband. And that's extremely alarming because all of us know, Republicans and Democrats, by the way, that if we're going to revive rural America and give it a shot at having a strong economy, we have to have public investment to build out broadband. The FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, did a study and said it would take about $40 billion in order to get that build out in rural America to have comparability with urban America. And that is something that we've really got to do. It was not addressed. And I thought, third, the issue on immigration, which is a very, very serious issue, is one where, once again, the president was unyielding in what I thought was a very harsh approach on addressing immigration. And he took away any chance, I think, for significant bipartisan progress.
Let's hear a little bit about what the president said on infrastructure, and then we can talk a little bit more about that. Here he is last night.
Tonight, I'm calling on Congress to produce a bill that generates at least $1.5 trillion for the new infrastructure investment that our country so desperately needs. Every federal dollar should be leveraged by partnering with state and local governments and, where appropriate, tapping into private sector investment to permanently fix the infrastructure deficit, and we can do it.
Now, Congressman Welch, you just mentioned that you didn't hear what you would have liked to have heard in that, in particular specifics. But on the face of it, a public-private partnership, you know, sounds like a good idea, but you don't like what he was saying.
Well, that's a good point. I like the $1.5 trillion. We need to spend that. It's going to be very tough to do that because we just added $2.3 trillion to the deficit for the unpaid-for tax cuts. And I know my colleagues on the Republican side are now going to be talking about the deficit as a restrictive matter so that we won't have that money. But the public – let's – talk concretely about the public-private partnership.
And let me clarify, too. You mentioned the FCC and broadband and rural broadband infrastructure. I took that part of the speech to be more roads and bridges.
That's correct. That's correct. And a lot of us have been pursuing the rural broadband build-out. In fact, I'm one of the co-chairs of the Rural Caucus, and we had three Republicans and three of my colleagues and three Democratic colleagues write a letter to the president urging him to include broadband. And I did a previous letter that had about 75 Democrats saying the same thing. And, you know, whether you're representing Vermont or a very rural district in Iowa or Colorado, the folks there need the broadband the same way we in Vermont need it. So the fact that the president didn't even mention is extremely disturbing. And his Republican side has that same need that we have in Vermont. Not mentioned, that's very ominous. But the public here's the thing on the on the infrastructure. When John Boehner was here, he was trying to push an infrastructure bill, and the holdup was that no one was willing to pay for it. And we started passing these 3-month extensions on the infrastructure bill, and I stopped voting for them because I said, you know, you can't plan, let alone build a bridge in 3 months. And I told the speaker, any revenue source that you can get attached to this that'll make it real so it can be permanent, I'll vote for it. I'll be agnostic on it. I won't fight for what I think is the best way to do it. President Trump isn't even trying to put a revenue source on the table. And what he's saying with public, quote, private partnerships is two things. One, the states are going to have to share a major part of the burden. Most of the information we're hearing is that the federal government would come up with about $200 billion out of that $1.5 trillion. So that means states like Vermont that have recently raised their gas tax, that are doing everything they can to use their resources and go to their citizens to help pay their share, are going to be asked to pay for more. Number two, that comes on the heels of a tax bill that is raising taxes for Vermonters who itemize their deductions, because those additional taxes that Vermonters might have to pay, they can't deduct from their federal liability, so they're going to pay higher federal taxes. Third, the private partnership only works for the hedge fund investors who would want to make a big return on their investment. The only way they can make a return on the investment is to do something in a big urban area. They're not going to do it in rural areas, number one. And number two, they're going to have to get tolls that are used to repay them for their investment. So then you're going to have users paying a significant toll that basically goes to provide the profit for the hedge fund investors. So this is really, in my view, not a serious proposal. He knows we need infrastructure. He's a builder. And he knows how bad our roads and bridges are, 55,000 deficient bridges in the country. But there's not a seriousness of purpose that is displayed when an executive offers a proposal but doesn't offer a concrete way to pay for it.
So, Congressman Welch, what do you see as a solution? I mean, let's take a state like Vermont, for example. You know, there are major infrastructure needs here. There are roads and bridges in varying states of disrepair. There are constant weather-related degradation to our infrastructure. And we have a governor who has said no to new taxes and new fees. We're constantly relying on federal dollars to help supplement what the state can provide. The governor is saying, look, we're not going to raise fees, we're not going to raise taxes. Towns are strapped. So, you know, is there a sort of a private-public solution that could work, or what, you know, where are we going to go with this?
Well, bottom line, there has to be a federal financial commitment to our roads and bridges. We haven't, by the way, on the Highway Trust Fund, that the gas tax on that hasn't been raised at the federal level since 1993. So the purchasing power of that trust fund is nothing close to what it used to be. So how do you come up with a federal share, a federal match? That's one question. Number two, there's an irony here. some of the great infrastructure leaders have been Republicans. I mean, the big debate that began about whether the federal role would get engaged in helping build out our infrastructure in the states was back in the days of Henry Clay. But it was Dwight Eisenhower who made the commitment to the interstate highway system. It was because of what he saw in Germany. And there was a huge federal commitment to building out the highways. And, of course, Vermont was a beneficiary of that. Ronald Reagan did a lot of work with the infrastructure. And those presidents, frugal as they were, they got it. They understood that potholes really don't fix themselves. And there's not such a thing as a Democratic or Republican pothole. Now, I've been working with some of my Republican colleagues down here who understand that. They get it, you know, that if you want to build out your infrastructure, you've got to have a dedicated fund in order to do it. And they have the confidence that if we actually raise money that goes into better roads, better bridges, better airports, better broadband build out, voters tend to reap the immediate benefits of that. And the process of undertaking that effort, rebuilding for the future, is something that creates really good jobs. And finally, that's an area where you actually legitimately can borrow. Because if we have a very good highway that's built, it'll be used by me, it'll be used by my kids, it'll be used by my grandchildren. So it's fair to spread that cost out over the generations of users who will benefit from this public investment. So it's an area of enormous potential, including potential for bipartisan cooperation. But you've got to have a president who, like, speaks truth on this. It's not free.
Well, and you bring up Republican presidents who have looked at infrastructure as a way to help the economy as well as deal with some of the federal spending. And certainly that was true in the Obama administration. I mean, we only need to look back to ERA, the American the Reimbursement and Reinvestment Act, whatever it was called, which
That's
was
right.
really dedicated to shovel-ready projects and certainly some Vermont projects that benefited.
That's right.
We got a note from Jordan who wants to just mention this. He says, as pointed out by many, including Paul Krugman in an op-ed piece today, the infrastructure program proposed by Trump is an attempt to privatize spending on the projects rather than pay for them by taxes. This would undoubtedly mean tax breaks for the private companies and things like toll increases. $200 billion of government money is not anywhere enough, and there is a built-in reliance on state governments to pick up a lot of the tab. Impossible in a state like Vermont, which does a lot of infrastructure repair on its own. You know, before we go into some of the other issues, I want to ask you one other question about the speech, which is we were told that you were going to take your brother as your guest. Did he go? And what did he think?
Well, my brother did go, and he was not a big fan of the speech. But we were getting into family political discussions we have around Thanksgiving table, which I'm not sure would excite the VPR listening audience. But he did enjoy it. And I enjoyed having my brother. I have three brothers and two sisters. And whenever I have a chance to have one of them with me, it's a great day.
Did he get one of the tickets with the misspelling, State of the Union?
He did, and that was called back, State of the Union.
So why didn't you want to make a political statement with your choice of guest as some other members of Congress did?
Well, two things. First of all, John asked me a while ago, and he hadn't been, and I had promised him, so I made a commitment to him. And number two, that's really the reason. Last year, I did have a Syrian refugee, and it was a wonderful opportunity to make that political statement. And many of my colleagues at this speech had Dreamers with them, and it was a wonderful embrace of a very righteous cause.
Again, today we're talking with Congressman Peter Welch, and if you have a question for him, you can call 800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. William is calling in from Berlin. Hi, William. Go right ahead.
Yes. My question is for Congressman Welch regarding a broadband initiative that was created back in late 2008 or 9, I believe. I can't remember exactly at this point. And my question is why no one took action to recover the money that was corrupted by Usenet that was granted to them by the Department of Agriculture for the intent of providing subsidized internet for broadband. I believe there were 7 or 9 states involved to share into the amount of money. And your office, as well as Senator Sanders' office, reached out to me. Your office reached out to me. And I got involved with Senator Leahy. I'm drafting a letter to the Department of Agriculture asking why Vermonters weren't qualifying as well as many others. I had all the answers. I had all the evidence of corruption. I went to the I was invited to speak at the Broadband Committee for the state of Vermont. Then no one wanted to hear the answers. No one wanted to take action. No one wanted to do anything. I even reached out to the Secretary of Attorney General of Vermont, and also on deaf ears. And I had given up a substantial amount of my time, and it actually led to the demise of my business.
William, I'm sorry to hear that. Representative Welch, do you have a response for William?
You know, I'm really sorry to hear about what happened to your business, and I don't have an answer for you, as apparently you've been getting frustrated by all your inquiries to various people, but I don't have an answer for you as we speak. I'd be glad to have you contact the office again and see what we can find out.
William does bring up some questions about broadband infrastructure, and you were talking about that earlier, Representative Welch. And, you know, just yesterday on this program, we were talking about how to attract more workers to the state of Vermont, and we got a lot of comments from listeners about connectivity in rural areas, and that is a very common refrain, as you know, a lack of broadband and cell coverage around the state. That's despite longstanding efforts by governors going back, you know, a decade and more now to get that last mile connectivity and more. I mean, even the places where theoretically they'd be considered connected, it's slow, it's spotty, it's not reliable. When it comes to that response, it sounds like you see a federal response more than just solely a state infrastructure build-out.
There has to be a federal response. About 39% of rural America doesn't have broadband, let alone adequate broadband, very, very slow. And we made a decision back in the 30s when electricity was really starting to expand, even before that, that we would have rural electrification. And the resistance to rural electrification was the economics. It doesn't pay for investors to be stringing wires for electricity in rural areas where you might have three houses in a mile. But our Congress back then and our president back then made a policy decision that we're all Americans, that we've all got to be connected, and we're going to find ways to fund a build-out. And this is an area where you can have a public-private partnership of electricity into rural America. And we got electricity into our barns scattered all over the country. And we have to make a similar decision now. And that means that there has to be a funding mechanism like the Universal Service Fund that is available to help make those public investments to wire rural America. And that is more important than ever. I've been hearing that from individuals. But what we're seeing is not just in Vermont but around the country is there's a significant migration into urban areas. Rural economy is on the ropes. You started out with the story about the price of milk. That's real pressure on lots of parts of Vermont. There's an opportunity for people who don't necessarily want to be in the city but who have a good business idea to do that business in a rural area. And a lot of folks love the values of people who live in rural communities. And we are so proud in Vermont of our small towns and our village centers and our town meetings. And a lot of other people envy us that. But if those rural places can't have connected, good, solid broadband, they're not going to be able to attract those folks who become entrepreneurs, create jobs, and create a viable living community. So my view is that we've got to bite the bullet here and acknowledge that this is going to take a public investment to make a public policy implementation that, just like electricity, we want the whole country to be wired.
Is there, if you really step back and look at the economics and look at the environment, and we know that globally people are moving into urban environments, we know that transportation is more expensive when you're incorporating rural transportation, we know that connectivity is more expensive, and we know that the trend is towards urban environments. Is there a sense that we should be saying to people, if you want to live in a rural place and, you know, use this landscape in that way, this is the price you pay. You don't have that connectivity. You don't have transportation.
You have asked a very fair public policy question, and I come down very squarely on the side of saying we should make a public policy decision to wire rural America. And by the way, I think that's important not just because a lot of Vermont is rural, but many of my colleagues all across this Congress, and more on the Republican side than the Democratic side, represent areas that have similar challenges to Vermont. And what I find so important, and I see this in Vermont, a lot of folks living in Burlington, it's a whole different, you know, it's a whole different a place to be than many of our small towns. Vermonters really value the traditions that we have benefited from by the folks who were the custodians of the land, the folks who lived in communities where neighbors knew neighbors, where you provided help when people needed it, where you were tolerant of people who were different because you got to see that they were really good people and the differences, whether it was their sexual orientation or their religion or any other issue, Vermonters were very tolerant is because we got to know each other. And I think we need that. I think it's good for a society to support that and to try to sustain it. And we can't just abandon our rural communities, and we are if we're not going to wire them. And I say that's true in Vermont, but I say it's true all across the country. And my argument on this actually is one of the things that's helped me to have good relations with a lot of my Republican colleagues with whom I disagree on many other issues.
I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, I'm talking with Congressman Peter Welch about his efforts in Washington to reach bipartisan agreement on immigration reform, infrastructure improvements, and other top issues that he's invested in. Paul in Lincoln says, please help the Democratic leadership understand that Democrats must come up with a positive message instead of primarily focusing on negative messages about our current president and administration. We Democrats can make major inroads in November, but we will be hindered if we just talk about all the destructive actions the president is taking. Jeffrey says, I know that Peter Welch has probably tried to get the Democratic caucus to bring out legislation that would serve as a counterpoint to the Republican legislation, and I'm wondering where the resistance comes from. Is it leadership or members in swing districts? Leadership can't believe that being anti-Republican is enough, can they? And before we get a response from you, let's go to another Peter who's calling in from Middlebury. Hi, Peter. Go right ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
I would want to echo those comments. I think that the Democratic Party, which I have voted for consistently, is becoming the party of no, which is what was so distasteful about the Republican resistance to President Obama. There are a great many reasons to mistrust this president. Nonetheless, there were some offers, particularly around immigration, that could be met with some enthusiasm by the Democrats. I think there will be, in fact, we lost the election, and there are some consequences for that. So I'll take my comments off the air at that point.
Peter, thanks. And Peter Welch?
Well, I agree with the listeners. What Paul said is almost word for word what I say in caucus. Here's how I see it, okay? I think Trump is a catastrophe as a president, and I've never seen anybody say things about people on the basis of their religion, or about women, about Muslims, a Muslim ban. It's terrible in my view. And the guardrails are down with him, and he's undermining institutional integrity. I think all of that. But having said that, I think the Trump dynamic has its own life, and it doesn't really need me every day saying what a bad guy Trump is. Vermonters are going to figure that out on their own and come to their own conclusions. I believe the better way for us in Congress is to say we want to do an infrastructure program and show how we're going to pay for it, make it real. And some people will criticize us if I say I might be willing to consider a gas tax, but at least it's real and we're having a real conversation. I think we've got to address health care and help start bringing the cost down. The Affordable Care Act has helped expand access. That's a good thing. But we've got to address cost. And one of the things I think we could advocate for, I do support single payer. I'm a co-sponsor of that bill. But I think we could aggressively advocate letting people age 50 and over buy into the Medicare program. That program works. It would save money overall and give people a very good option. And I think that it's really important for us, even though we're in the minority, to try to make the effort to work with Republicans on specific issues where we can find some common ground. I work with some Republicans And we got a bill passed that is going to help us stop opioids coming in at the border and slipping through the Postal Service. And there was a bill signing in the Oval Office with President Trump. And I'm no fan of the president, as you just heard, but that was a concrete step forward that was done on a bipartisan basis, and we should do it. So for those who say we should have our own plan, I'm with you. I am. And just focusing on Trump is not a good thing, because it's just the back and forth in Washington that people are pretty fed up with.
So then when you talk about being a member of a bipartisan group that's working on finding common ground and finding legislation, it does seem like that's thin on the ground when it comes to actually getting policies passed. So, I mean, is it an exercise in spinning your wheels, or do you feel like you're getting somewhere?
Well, we're definitely getting somewhere. But there also can be a feeling of how steep the hill is to climb. And I'll tell you why. For instance, I was part of this group, Problem Solvers, and with another colleague, a Republican colleague, we drafted a letter, and we've got the Problem Solvers to support it, to Paul Ryan on immigration. And what it says is not that we are demanding an outcome. We want our version of immigration reform to pass. We said, Mr. Ryan, put every serious proposal on the floor for a vote so that all of us have an opportunity to state where we stand on immigration issues. And that would, there's a Queen of the Hill process, it's called, and the one that got the most votes would pass. But that approach, if the speaker would allow that to happen, America would see a real debate about the various proposals on immigration reform, and we'd have an outcome that would then be considered potentially by the Senate. So that's a constructive step where my colleagues on the Republican side, who share my sense of urgency about reforming the way this institution operates, we're working together on that. The challenge in the House is that under the rules, the Speaker alone is the one who can decide whether a bill would be put on the floor for a vote or not. And that's really crucial on something on immigration, like where in the case of the Dreamers DACA, if the Speaker allowed that to be put on the floor for a vote, it would pass by a very substantial margin. But it's instead just being used as leverage to try to get their way on other things, and that's with the full support of President Trump. So I don't feel it's futile. I feel that however difficult it is, when you have this opportunity to be the voice of Vermont in the House of Representatives, every day I'm getting up trying to figure out how do we just reform this institution and have it start focusing on the needs of everyday Americans.
Is Speaker Ryan not being a good representative of the American public in that case? Do you think he is an obstructionist?
I'm very disappointed in how he's running a speakership, because what he's done is he's adopted what they call the Hastert rule. But here's what it means: that instead of the committees being given the assignment to come up with a tax bill, or a committee being assigned the responsibility to come up with a health care bill, these things are being written in the Speaker's office with no committee input whatsoever. So, for instance, the health care bill, that was written in secret. It was presented to the Energy and Commerce Committee, on which I sit, at 10 o'clock in the morning. My Republican colleagues hadn't even seen it. They basically locked the doors. We were there for 27 hours trying to read it and make amendments. And then when everyone's exhausted, there was a party line vote and it came out. And most members didn't even know what was in it. And then we didn't even have the score from the Congressional Budget Office, the neutral and respected arbiter, as to A, how much it would cost, and B, how many people would lose health care. And it turned out in the days after the bill was already passed that the 24 million Americans were going to lose their health care. That's in the control of the Speaker, so I don't respect that. The Speaker has to be there for the institution as well as playing an advocacy role for the party and to some extent for the president is of his party. But the institution is broken when you have major bills that affect so much of the economy written in secret without any witnesses, not a single witness at all. That's terrible.
Let's get another call in here from a Vermonter. John is on the line with us from Richmond. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hello, Jane. Hello, Congressman. in listening to your comments, I realize there's challenges from a congressional standpoint, but it seems what seems to be missing is a strategic approach to the president. He's very transactional. And it seems that Congress has been reacting to it, and it's somewhat echoing the previous callers and emailers. I'm concerned that if we're going to talk about, say, immigration and the values of immigration, that there's no general consensus, not even a proposed consensus as to what the value of immigration is. That could be, if you ask 10 people right now what that would be, you'd get 10 different answers. You know, if the opposition wants to, the center and the left wants to have some, gain some ground, you'd have to have something that people know what you're talking about. And I'm kind of baffled why you can't find a way to take what the president has said and said, these are the consequences, these are the short-term and long-term consequences, and then say, here's our proposals based on these five values, and these are the consequences that we propose. Whether it goes through the Speaker's office or not, if he's acting unconventionally and you're playing by the rules, frankly, you lose every time. So I'm wondering...
John, let's put that to Congressman Welch, because, you know, again, last night, the president said, I support a path to citizenship, for example, for children who were brought here illegally. I want them to have this chance for legal status. And in fact, I want them to have a path to citizenship. Now, he said that before. Then he's reneged on what appears to be a deal. So, you know, to John's point about how do you go around, how do you find a way to interact with him in a way that then is going to get passage? Is there a way, or do you feel like you're negotiating in good faith and then suddenly what you thought was happening isn't?
Well, that clearly has been the case with President Trump. I mean, what he says in the morning is not what he says in the afternoon, and that's been constant. So it's very difficult to have a ongoing and successful negotiation with somebody who keeps changing their position and moving the goalpost. That is a fact. But the caller raises a couple of significant points that are very vexing to me because he asked, why don't we have our clear position? Well, a lot of folks here, and I think me among them, would have a clear position. But the way the media works now, it's much different than it used to be in the recent past. Everybody goes to the cable network that tells them what they want to hear on the news. The role of facts are much more in dispute. So the media landscape is so much very different. And we saw that, of course, with the success that President Trump had with Twitter. And the second issue, and this is why congressional reform and process reform is so important to me, to get that type of dialogue that the caller was seeking rightly, you really do have to have a committee process. You have a proposal. It is presented to the committee in open hearings. You have witnesses come in. They lay out what they see as the advantages or disadvantages, and something that should have been done on the tax bill, where you actually get people who study this to give you projections about the unintended consequences that may occur, the likely good things that may happen, and you have that discussion and debate. It gets reported in the public, and things get winnowed down ultimately to a conclusion. It's actually how it worked when I served in the Vermont Senate. You know, we had open hearings. And the chairs of committees were influential people, and they had to work out a lot of these honest differences. We don't have that in Congress. And that's where I'm really critical of the Speaker, because he had been a champion of what is called the open process. Regular order is the term that's used, where a bill is referred to a committee. The committee has open hearings and witnesses. They report back. He was a champion of that, and he's abandoned that since he became Speaker. And I think it's all to the degradation of having good public policy and just getting these political outcomes. And again, it's why so much of my time is spent trying to forge relationships with Republicans who share my concern to try to make this institution work. People don't like Congress, but Congress is actually a constitutional creation, and it's important that it work if America is going to make progress. Our job simply should be to do things here have policies here that make it more possible for people back home to succeed in their lives and in their jobs.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. And today we're spending the hour with Vermont's Congressman in the House of Representatives, Peter Welch. He's joining us from Washington today, and we've been reflecting on President Trump's State of the Union address last night, as well as some of the issues that Congressman Welch is working on at the federal level and some of the areas where Vermonters are particularly affected. Don is calling in from Queechee. Hi, Don. Go ahead.
Hi, and hello, Congressman. I just want to know the status of an issue that pertains and it affects all Vermonters, the status of the bill that you and Elijah and Representative Elijah Cummings have written on prescription drug prices. And thank you.
Don, thank you very much for that question. You know, somebody was asking, working with the president, Elijah Cummings, Congressman from Maryland, and I were invited to the White House to talk prescription drugs with the president. I think it was March, a couple of months into his presidency. We had an hour meeting with him. It was very good. The president said all the right things. He gets it that pharma prices are a ripoff. He gets it that they've got monopoly power and they're abusing it. And he gets it that it is a hardship on everyday Americans. And he gets it that the politics of government providing some consumer protection is good politics. But then it was radio silence. Congressman Cummings and I gave him our bill that would have allowed for price negotiation. You know, in the Veterans Administration, when they buy in bulk, they get a better price. Just like if you go to the store and buy 100 Aspen, your per unit cost is a lot cheaper than if you buy 25. And it's an astonishing thing, but in the Medicare prescription drug program, Part D, it's illegal for the free market principle of a buyer and a seller to negotiate a price. And that's our legislation. It's very simple. It's got broad support. It would save billions and billions of dollars. We heard nothing from the White House. And then last night, when you were listening to that speech, the president said he really wants to do something on prescription drug prices. Mm-hmm. So there's been nothing between – no action between the meeting in March and the president's speech. But he said it last night, and I'm going to take him at his word, and I'm talking to Congressman Cummings, and we're going to see if we can follow up. If the president is saying it now, let's see the action to back up the words. But right now, nothing's happened. But my hope, it springs eternal, that the president's going to follow through.
Another thing that the president said last night in his speech that may have raised the eyebrows of some Democrats and maybe provided some hope was his support for paid family leave. Do you see a policy coming that he would support on that?
That was music to my ears. I hope he does. His daughter apparently has a real interest in that. So will there be a way to pay for that? But more and more people are seeing and employers are seeing the wisdom of paid family leave. Now, how you pay for it is obviously a challenge, but people have children, and that's a good thing. And employers have to have some flexibility in order to accommodate the good things that happen in families and the bad things that happen in families when a partner gets sick and needs the help of that partner. So if the president said the right thing there, let's take a look at the policy and hope it is much more follow through than we got on prescription drugs. But, you know, I want to say another thing about the division of the presidency. This is the aspect of President Trump that is so troubling to me. He's divisive, and it's an approach and attack that worked for him very well in the Republican primaries, but is not good for governing. Last night he said something that caught my ear when he was talking about immigration. He said Americans are dreamers too, and he was really making a connection between the dreamers like Juan Conde, who is a UVM medical student. Americans are dreamers, and they aspire to achieve things for themselves and their families. But American dreamers have American citizenship. They're able to take on the challenges of trying to reach that dream without the worry that they're going to get picked up and deported to a country that they really don't know. And the president, I think, has said that he supports the Dreamers. These are people like Juan, a medical student who's dedicated to helping others. It's the Houston first responders who were That terrible flood they had down there, and the first responders were folks who were brought over by their parents, and they were young, 2 or 3 or 4 years old. And shouldn't a unifying approach be to say that these people have their own righteous cause, that they have served their country, they're becoming medical students, they're first responders, they're in our military, and we're going to provide legal status for them and not use them as a bargaining chip on some of these other issues that are contentious in immigration. And a unifier would do that. And in fact, in one of the meetings I was at with the president, I just urged him to do it. This is a Lincoln-esque moment where you'd have an opportunity to do something we all, on our side and mostly on your side, believe is the right thing to do for innocent people. And you do that, and it creates its own merit. It actually creates goodwill. So some of those more contentious issues about border security and the wall and other things, you tone it down a little bit, and you're able then to make progress when you create mutual trust.
And in fact, most polls suggest that most Americans support finding a path for those people known as the Dreamers.
Well, that's right. And instead of, you know, why not just do the right thing because it's the right thing to do and not see it as a tactic to try to gain leverage to do something that really is hotly disputed?
You know, Congressman Welch, over the years, I and Bob Kinzel and other reporters have pressed you on this idea of bipartisanship, which you have always championed. And you have pushed back and defended it. No, no, this can work. I'm in Congress to be a part of the solution. I'm in Congress to work with others, and the system can work. I hear a lot more pessimism, a lot more sort of sadness in your responses today, and it feels like a different turn for you in how you perceive the way Congress is working and how well you can work within the system.
What's different here is this president. I've never seen anything like this. I mean, every president that in my lifetime, whether I was in Congress or not, whether I agreed with him or not, accepted the importance of our institutions. They didn't tear them down. You now have a president who's attacking the Justice Department, who's attacking the FBI, not calling it to do a better job, not standing up for the rule of law, but attacking these institutions. This is a president who's appointed as the head of the EPA, someone who doesn't think the EPA should exist, who spent all his time litigating against the Clean Air Act. It's a person who's the head of the Energy Department that said he wanted to abolish it, except the only reason he didn't say that is he couldn't remember that was one of the three departments that he wanted to abolish. I mean, this is not a president who's normal. I mean, it's as simple as that. We've had presidents who believe in institutions. Their policies might be different than mine. I might argue tooth and nail about what the policy should be, but they would believe in the importance of the role of government and the importance of building sustainable institutions to work on behalf of Americans. That's not the case right now. So if you hear some concern in my voice, it's real. You've detected something that is deep in me. But these are the times we're in. And where I get my energy now, it's really seeing the work that Vermonters are doing back home. A lot of times people ask me, Peter, what can I do? And I say, you know, Bernie Patrick and I are on the same page down here. We're showing up every day and doing everything we can. But what's going to get us through this is people recommitting themselves to do things and sustain democracy and sustain community at the local level. And I just get inspired by the things I see Vermonters doing at that local level.
Well, Congressman Peter Welch, I appreciate you telling us a little bit about your perspective and sharing the hour with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.